You're listening to a podcast from the Media Motel. Coming up this week in episode 329, what's the big deal with George Michael? Oh, we share our love for George. And after the incident at Everton, why do some men treat sport as war? Gladiators. And we break the golden rule of broadcasting. Never talk about your dreams. It's all coming up after George Michael and Mary J. Blige.
my favourite singers of all time on one record. A hit all around the world in 1999, except in the United States, where it wasn't released because, according to George Michael, MCA Records didn't want their star Mary J. Blige to be linked to George, as this was recorded shortly after the situation in Will Rogers Memorial Park.
Oh yes. I remember it being an additional track or a single released to flog his best of, I think, which brilliantly he called Ladies and Gentlemen.
Yes, well, it was a pathetic and dismal decision by MCA.
Yes, it was, because that is a wonderful, wonderful version, I think. I think you have to be pretty good to be able to successfully cover. Is it Stevie Wonder?
It's a Stevie Wonder song, yeah.
Yes, but it's wonderful. It's such a lovely duet. I think it's a complete star of a turn. And God bless, or whatever the opposite of God bless MCA is. Mm. Let's apply that in this situation.
So George Michael and Mary J. Blige, and a cover, as Jules says, of Stevie Wonder's Sublime As. And more on George Michael in a minute. But first of all, welcome to the podcast from the Parish Council. It's episode 329. And 329 also happens to be a bus route from Glasgow city centre to Stob Hill.
I'm enjoying bus route of the week, like Harry Hill's TV highlight of the week on TV Burp. Where will we go next week, Terence?
Well, that remains to be seen, but Article 329 is the Lisbon Treaty of the European Union.
How totally topical.
And Cafe 329 is a restaurant open from 7 a.m. on weekdays in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Please don't take these as personal endorsements. This is information only.
Absolutely. We've got no buses, no treaties or cafes on the agenda this week. But we do have me, I'm Terence Stackham, and not from Lafayette, Louisiana, but from Sussex by the Sea, it's Juliet Harris.
Absolutely. Hello. Yes, I am. No one's sorrier than I am that I'm not from Lafayette, Louisiana. Don't get me wrong, I love my hometown, but it'd be nice to be from somewhere a bit more exotic that wasn't being battered by Naughty Storm Brian, frankly.
Oh, you're getting it heavily down there?
I got caught in hail on Saturday morning whilst carrying lots of boxes of records and had to call for assistance. A very heavily bearded man ran out and helped me. It was not ideal, but anyway.
Oh, so you had a beard accompanying you this week.
Yes, as most weeks, yes, indeed. Anyway, hello and good morning, everyone.
Jules, earlier this week, there was an interesting, a little flawed documentary on George Michael Channel 4 here in the UK. And although it was made in-house and co-directed by George, it still had some moments, particularly Talking Heads, who could have been dropped out of the whole thing, which would have made a coherent hour rather than the 90 minutes that included rather flippant interviews with Ricky Gervais, James Corden. Mm-hmm. I kept thinking, what have you got to do with George Michael?
I have problems. Well, you know, James Corden hasn't exactly covered himself in glory recently anyway, but I'm finding the two of them, their shtick of always kind of, you know, turning up to the opening of an envelope as far as documentaries are concerned, and just kind of being their sort of slightly smug selves. I do find that to be somewhat inessential.
Much of the rest was quite insightful. If we had to have guests to be interviewed, rather strange, as it was in-house, where were Andrew Ridgeley, Pepsley and Shirley, Kenny Goss, other people who actually formed and shaped much of his life in the 80s and early 90s?
And given that he had been involved in it, I would have understood if it was something that had been made without his cooperation.
Exactly,
because I know that Andrew Ridgeley does keep a very low profile, and, you know, fair enough. But having said that, the fact that he was involved did make me wonder why they didn't want to do it, really.
Well, all that struck me was, I wonder if it was because this film, obviously started clearly with his consent before he died, whether it was initially conceived as a reflection on his battles with Sony and his contractual issues there. And it was only after his death that the remit for this documentary was widened.
To sort of celebrate George generally.
Exactly,
yes, okay,
so.
Fair enough.
Now, it may seem in some ways absurd to suggest that George Michael was underrated, considering the awards and accolades over the years. But I propose that he was and is underrated, as for so long in his career, he was forever having to show that he had matured from his pop career with Wham.
Yes.
And I think he felt it himself in that he was always trying to show that that was then, this is now. And certainly in the press, and particularly the music press, there was this kind of snobbishness because of the Wham years. And yet he was an incredible songwriter, outstanding singer, musician, arranger and producer. And Jules, I'm just thinking it's possible to be an enormous star yet still be underrated.
Yes, I agree, actually. I think, you know, you're pitching to the converted as far as George is concerned with me, because I've always been an enormous George Michael fan. It was quite interesting, by the way. I saw a bit of the documentary. It was hilarious that turns out that Liam Gallagher is a huge George Michael fan. And actually, I found that to be quite endearing, actually.
But again, one thinks, you know, why have... I know we've, you know, we've put the caveat in already, but you think, why have Liam Gallagher when you don't have Andrew Ridgeley?
I suppose if you can't get those people for whatever reason, then you should at least have someone entertaining. But anyway, I was a huge fan of, even at the same time as I mentioned Liam Gallagher, because I was sort of listening to George Michael in the 90s, and I was aware of Wham. I did like Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. I knew that he'd been in Wham and that sort of thing, and I liked the occasional stuff that I'd heard on the radio, so Too Funky, I thought that was brilliant, and particularly because he breaks the fourth wall at the end and his mum appears to be shouting at him to turn the radio off because he's trying to get to sleep. I always really liked that, and that's exactly the sort of nerdy technical stuff that I really enjoy, and I liked Faith and all that kind of thing. But I first got into George Michael, actually, you talk about his need to show that he'd matured. His solo album Older that came out in 97 that had Fast Love on it, I absolutely loved that. And then I had Ladies and Gentlemen on tape. I remember coming back from my first school trip abroad in Italy. I came back on Good Friday. The two big news stories were the Good Friday Agreement, which I think we said proves I heard about on a payphone at Luton Airport. Yeah. And when I came home and turned on Teletext, those were the days, I read of George Michael's unfortunate incident that we've mentioned involved in the public toilets. And actually, I think maybe he's underrated because the Older album is actually quite a serious album, and he was trying very, or rather they were trying very hard to market him as a single artist and as a serious artist, and they've got some beautiful songs on that album. I mean, Jesus to a Child is one of the most beautiful songs I think he's ever written, and so I think that's fantastic. But actually, the thing that's always perhaps has stopped George Michael from being quote unquote taken seriously is the fact that he didn't always take himself very seriously, and I think actually that's much to be admired, really, in that I do find it to be irritating when people like Lenny Kravitz, for example, if we're talking about sort of soul-y singers, are very po-faced and sort of talk about their art and that sort of thing. And I do rather like the fact that George Michael did the video to Outside. I don't think Outside wasn't on Older. I don't think it was just after Older. He did that wonderful video of the sort of him dressed up as a policeman dancing and that sort of thing, and calling his out, you know, his album Ladies and Gentlemen shortly after that. I had a very good sense of self. I think he joined Twitter in later years, and that was hilarious. I mean, this is a woman that tweets called Scouse Rachel Roberts, that did this wonderful story for her trying to teach George Michael how to use Twitter, and he did these wonderful tweets about how he didn't care at all about if people thought he was gay, and, you know, they should just stop being so sad and bug off, basically. I will always be an enormous fan of George Michael because I'm from a generation of people, and actually this goes to show his impact. I think I was too young for him in sort of the 80s, but, you know, even in the 90s he was still an icon. And obviously he was rather forcibly outed by the toilet incident, but he made records after that. You know, he would make records unashamedly about the fact that he was a gay man. And I really admired the fact that he sort of taught generations of us kids that it was okay to grow up and be unashamedly gay and unashamed about the sort of stuff that's involved in being gay. And I think there's this horrendous double standard that, you know, there's so much sort of, you know, it's so much gratuitous scenes of sex, heterosexual sex in things, when, as you know, as long as I can remember, that's always been fine. Whereas if when it comes to homosexual sex, you know, because of gay sex and that sort of thing, it's, you know, it's never been, you know, it's less casually used in things. It's only ever used in dramas that are gay dramas, you know, if you put those in inverted commas. So actually I really admired George Michael for just kind of doing it, you know, just kind of going out and doing it like that, really. And just also, like you say, aside from all of that, and, you know, one of the reasons why I mind him so much is that he is a damn good singer. I mean, he's an amazing, you know, there's that amazing footage, and I'm sorry that we have to wait until people die before actually celebrating them, but there was, when he died, it was Boxing Day, wasn't it, this year? Last year, rather. I can't believe where the time's going, 2016. There was this wonderful footage of him at, was it Live Aid or
no, it's rehearsing for the Queen, the Freddie Mercury tribute.
Yeah. And they had him singing Somebody to Love, and
David Bowie
was watching him from the side of the stage, and he just sings the hell out of it. And, you know, no one can hold a candle to Freddie Mercury, but he pretty much does. And, you know, like you say, maybe one of the reasons that he is underrated is that Wham were unashamedly a pop band. I mean, you know, and again, I really admired them for not ever really taking themselves seriously whilst making absolutely bomb-proof music that, you know, I still play when DJing out, and still, you know, still are absolute winners. You know, they still work completely. And you know, yeah, so he starts off with this kind of, you know, ridiculous sort of pop career, and maybe that's why he wasn't taken seriously. I don't know, maybe because he didn't take himself seriously. But actually, he produced some wonderful music, which I think will sort of live on forever, really. And maybe we need to be prompted to take people seriously. Maybe if they don't take themselves seriously, we think, oh, well, you know, if there isn't all this kind of humph about them, maybe you just think, oh, you know, I don't know, maybe, you know, we don't take him as seriously as, for example, Leonard Cohen, because Leonard Cohen always held himself in a different way. I don't know. And having said that, if you go too far down that road, you end up with Bono, don't you? So I don't really know what the answer is on that, but I am sorry that I hope that George becomes more appreciated over time, although I am sorry that he had to pass away in order for that to happen.
Of course, the tabloids love the story is when George Michael's life went a little off track, but as is the way of the world, there's less interest in the kind, quiet gestures he made throughout his life. Don't think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, or this story, actually. I mean, for a while, I worked at Capital Radio in London, and then later, I would go back to help during their annual appeal called Help a London Child.
Oh, yes.
And one year, George Michael called in and very, very quietly donated £100,000
to help amazing.
A London child. Asked for it not to be publicised that he'd done so. His sister had been listening with him in the house and had just sort of drawn his attention to it, and he just gave £100,000, a huge sum now, even more so in the late 1980s.
Yeah.
But I really want to endorse something you said a few minutes ago. I really couldn't agree with you more. If at home you've never really listened to George Michael, I hope you'll understand that I agree with George. I want to really point you to what is my favourite album of his as well. It's that 1996 is Older, because it's a collection of emotional, highly moving songs. It is on Spotify if you'd like to listen to it. And in a way, as I think you said, it's both sad and uplifting, because it followed the first time that he really felt he had somebody that he loved and who loved him in his life, Anselmo Felipe. And it reflects, the songs on it reflect, unfortunately, Anselmo Felipe died. And it has, as you said, Jesus to a Child, Fast Love, Older, Spinning the Wheel, Star People, You Have Been Loved. Absolutely outstanding albums.
Wonderful songs. And also what you say about the kind of the sadness and his partner that died. Where around the time that he died, obviously lots of us wrote sort of tributes on Facebook. And I've got a lovely friend who is, and I mean this kindly, and he would describe himself as a gay man of a certain age. And he was probably sort of, I don't know, maybe 20s when this kind of was around, and he was at that sort of going out stage, and he said that it was a big song for him and his sort of gay male friends, and they were all sort of going out on the rads and that sort of thing. But he said that the thing that always struck him about Fast Love was the idea of this kind of looking for, even though it's meant to be a kind of an upbeat song, there is a kind of a thread of sadness that runs through it if you listen to it. I think Fast Love is outstanding, because it's got this kind of slight melancholy underpinning it, really. And of course, his partner Sandy died of AIDS, and I think my friend was sort of saying that even at that time, although things were, you know, we'd moved on from the total crisis of the 80s as far as AIDS was concerned, at that time still being a gay man and you know, sort of leading a slightly party lifestyle was still slightly fraught with danger. And I think that if you listen to Fast Love carefully, you can hear so much in it, I think. And I really enjoyed my friend's post. It made me listen to it slightly differently, and I could really understand, I can imagine the kind of times that would soundtrack that would be very happy, but also with this kind of edge of sort of slight melancholy and sort of the idea that you know, in the past, when you think about things being disposable, you think of things being disposable and fun, the pop music, but actually sometimes there's a sadness to things being disposable as well. And I think that Fast Love really kind of, the emotional palette is enormous, I think. And I think it really does show that although you say that he, you know, to some extent was forced to prove that he was serious, he really did develop as an artist. And like you say, I think that the tabloids were so desperate to paint these kind of poor George stories, and I'm sorry that he, you know, that perhaps he did have a slightly sort of, not sad end, but I'm sorry that he was sort of, he hadn't been very well, and he was sort of, you know, perhaps didn't necessarily die on a high. But having said that, I do like the fact, no matter how hard the tabloids tried to kind of paint these sort of stories, George Michael would do things like, you know, filming that video in the toilets, and he would always find a way of somehow being in control. And I also very much miss, my mum said this once, she said, oh, the good thing about George Michael getting into terrible trouble is that you always knew that he would go on Parkinson 6 months later and he'd be brilliant, and you'd know that the way that he kind of say it would never be George's fault, it would always be something else. But you'd see this kind of teenage boy in him that probably got into so many scrapes at home and got away with it with his mum every single time, because he was just so open and so witty and kind of self-deprecating about it all, and kind of, oh yeah, I've messed up. And I really, you know, and I remember him being very amused by the fact that he had some problems with cannabis, and he famously crashed his car into the Hampstead Heath branch of Snappy Snaps, the photography store, and some wit had graffitied Wham where the car had hit the thing, and he was very amused by that. And so I really like the idea that George always kind of kept ownership, and no matter how hard the tabloids tried to kind of, you know, sort of smear him or do him in, George always kind of was one step ahead, I think. So you know, the expression rest in peace, someone introduced me to a slightly different version of that recently, which I love and shall use from now on. So rest in power, George Michael.
Excellent. Now, in a month's time in Brisbane, England will take on Australia in the first match in the 5-Test Ashes series. As soon as you step on that line, it's war, says David Warner, the Australian vice-captain.
Maybe the clue is in his name, I don't know.
Exactly. Do you need a sense of battle and hatred to succeed in sport or even in life? That's next, right after Throwing Muses. With your bright yellow gun, you own the sun, and I think I need a little poison to keep me tame, keep me away. I have nothing to offer but confusion, and a circus in my
absolutely love that. I discovered that. I was slightly late to the party with Throw Muses, but I had this wonderful compilation, CD compilation, that I found at university called Lady Killers, which was called Music to Die For. And it was basically a sort of a 96, 97 era sort of Britpop-esque compilation that also had some interesting 4AD type stuff on it as well. Mm. And that song was on it. So that was Bright Yellow Gun by the Throw Muses. And it came out in 95, I think, originally.
I've always liked what I've heard from Throwing Muses, but I'm so ill-informed that I only found out this week when I saw you chosen this track that Kristen Hirsch and Tanya Donnelly are stepsisters.
Yes, you see, that's... No, absolutely. Indeed, yes. And it has to be said that there's lots of sort of sisters around that kind of... Tanya Donnelly always seems to end up in bands with her sister or with sisters, because she then, of course, was in the Breeders with the Deal sisters.
Of course. Now, most games, when I'm sitting in the stand at Chelsea, when I'm wondering why we didn't buy another striker in the summer, that sort of thing, a chant starts up behind the goal at the north end of Stamford Bridge. It then gathers momentum until it echoes around the ground. Stand up if you hate Tottenham is the rudimentary lyric.
Yes.
And I refuse to stand or join in.
No, fair enough.
Hate is a wasted emotion. I say to anyone around me who'll listen, which isn't many people at all, to be honest.
Anyone would think they hated you, Terence?
Exactly, they probably do, because I don't stand up. But the older I get, the less I want to express hatred at all. Mm-hmm. And as far as Tottenham are concerned, it's a ridiculous, manufactured hostility. I rather admire their style, their manager, the goals of Harry Kane. So it was with some dismay this week that I read that the Australian cricket vice captain David Warner is wheeling out the old cliches ahead of the Ashes. He says, "You try and get into a battle as quick as you can. I try and look in the opposition's eyes to try and work out how can I dislike this player? How can I get on top of him?" Jules, isn't it always blokes, and indeed only a certain type of bloke, who comes up with this form of so-called motivation?
Yes, I think so, actually. End of topic. No.
Coming next.
It's tricky, isn't it? I mean, in order for sport to work, there has to be competitiveness, because otherwise it would just be 22 people passing a football to each other or people bowling underarm, or, you know, just very kind of it wouldn't work. And that's what makes sport so interesting, I think, and so compelling, when people push themselves to extremes. And the reason the people are pushing themselves to extremes is that they want to be better than anyone else. And even where you have team games, they become even more intense, I think, because you have a whole team of people whose sole goal that binds them together is to be better than the other group of people. I can understand why sport needs to be competitive in order for it to be sport, really. That's what makes it. That's what the idea of kind of driving yourself and fulfilling yourself is. It's not the only arena in which that is the case. And actually, it's very interesting. I think I've mentioned this book before. Alistair Campbell's book, Winners, is really worth a read, actually. I got a lot of insight from it, because he makes the point that if you look at the characteristics of people that succeed in business and in politics and in sport, there are actually various characteristics and methods of thinking that kind of link all three of them. So actually, I know that it's not the only arena in which you have to be competitive in order to get places, but that is it's fundamental. But having said that, I think it can tip too far, and I have to say I do. And I it doesn't really help the kind of lobby. It doesn't help guard against lobby people going, "Oh, why do you care about this? It's only sport. It's outrageous that there's so much money in sport. Sport is a waste of time. It gets too much priority," that sort of thing. I mean, yes, we've both talked previously on the podcast in various contexts about the problems that we have with how much money there is in sport. But having said that, if you're trying to kind of, you know, make the argument that sport is a valid thing to be interested in, and it's valid to be on the news, which I think it is, there's occasionally an argument of why is sport on the news, but my view is, if, you know, that many people are interested in it, why shouldn't it be? Having said that, if you're then going to start talking about, you know, oh, it's war and, you know, that sort of thing, when there are literal wars going on in the world, then it starts to make you sound a bit silly, I think. So when you talk about sort of warfare on the cricket pitch, you feel like saying, you're not going to stand on a landmine at any point, though, David, are you really? So you know, I find that a bit ridiculous, I must admit. And the Ashes seems to, but England and Australia competing in any sport always seems to bring out the worst in people. My experience is playing football as women's football previously, are that yes, women can be as competitive as men. I've been involved in various incidents of violence, mild and sometimes occasionally potentially not mild on a pitch. But afterwards, it's always very kind of you know, I made friends with people that played on other teams. You know, there was always, you know, teenage girls of a certain age, and sports, women's football has always been quite popular amongst LGBT people, so occasionally you'd hear of people going out with each other that were on different teams. That was always quite entertaining. So there's always a kind of a camaraderie, because you all, although you're perhaps on different teams and you're competing, you all play sport. And particularly when I was playing women's football, it wasn't fashionable at all. It didn't have any level of the TV coverage that it did now, and so as a result of which, there was a slight siege mentality to it, that 22 of you had given up a Sunday morning to go and play in the tin shed, you know. So actually I find David Warner's comments to be quite telling, and actually I think England should be very encouraged by them, because I think you've got someone rolling out, you know, trying to sort of intimidate you and kind of say, it's war and I'm going to destroy you. What's that old saying? Empty vessels make the most noise.
Well, this David Warner has form, of course. He's the fellow who punched Joe Root in a Birmingham bar 4 years ago. And he was also he made some really inflammatory comments about Jonathan Trott when Trott had to withdraw from the 2013 series due to stress.
I do find some Australian players to be quite unpleasant, I must admit. But then having said that, we've talked about the trials of Ben Stokes, haven't we?
I'm not at all sure that this form of kind of manic motivation helps players perform much better. And it reminded me, I think many of us will remember Joe Hart going berserk in the tunnel before games in Euro 2016 in a misplaced attempt to G up his fellow players. And we all know how well that ended up. And I imagine there may be a sizable number of people who would disagree with me. But honestly, this is absolutely true. I'd rather lose a sporting contest by behaving decently than win it by screaming abuse at the opposition or the referee, or stand up if you hate Tottenham. And I think it must be a rather peculiar person who reaches, let's say, the autumn of their life and reflects back with glee that they won a cricket match by, you know, aggression, intimidation. I mean, that's the Donald Trump approach to life transferred to sport. And it's also, it's not a welcome visitor. It's also leads to situations like the toddler carrying Everton fan taking a punch at the opposition goalkeeper in the middle of the week. So whether
who's now been banned for life, apparently,
and quite
Everton,
rightly
so,
too.
So whether
England or Australia win the Ashes, I just say let it be by proving to be the better cricket team rather than by dint of being the best at screeching abuse at the opposition.
And if you find yourself in a position where screeching abuse is your biggest weapon, then what does that say about how well you play cricket?
Now, it's often said that there is nothing more tedious than other people talking about their dreams. Coming next, dreams! We tell you about ours! That's next, right after Talking Heads. the True Stories album in 1986 and also featured later in an episode of your The Simpsons, the ultimate accolade, Talking Heads and Dream Operator.
Absolutely. I'm an enormous fan of Talking Heads, I think, as regular listeners know. And I think I introduced you to the Kermit the Frog doing Once in a Lifetime, didn't I? I still think of that every time I hear that record.
So topics to turn people off at dinner parties or podcasts include Brexit, the challenges of being vegan, how the person on the checkout at Waitrose forgot to give you the little green tokens.
Illnesses as well.
That's right, yes. And dreams. Never expect anyone to be interested in your dreams. With that in mind, I had too much to dream last Sunday night, it was.
Had you been consuming too many electric prunes?
You're well spotted. You spotted the reference there. You did.
I don't just sit here. I do give some input.
Very impressive. Now, I woke up with a start and I looked at the clock. It was 3:17 a.m.
This is always peak dream time, I think.
Well, the dream was so vivid that it retained in my memory. And a week later, I can still recall it. And it largely featured Juliet.
Wow. Gosh, aren't you a lucky chap? Well, quote unquote.
We were sitting next to each other. And each time I turned towards you in my dream, more and more of your hair had disappeared until, just as I woke up, you were left with this, like, Friar Tuck ring of it was a stylish bob from the hair, but only at the side of your head. On the top, you were completely bald.
Well, I'm actually having my hair cut next week, so you've given me some hairspiration, so thank you for that.
Well, naturally, the next morning, I turned to the internet where there are sites that analyse dreams, and it turns out that I'm transferring my own concerns about ageing and a preoccupation with my appearance, and apparently I need to remember my good points and mustn't focus on what I cannot change that comes with age.
Well, that,
and I was transferring that onto you.
And that's sound advice for us all, I think.
Well, I suppose. So I feel I must apologise for casting you in my dreams. But this is what I'm interested in, whether anybody else, and particularly, of course, you, feel this way too. I really don't like dreams at all. Just about all the dreams I have that I remember are horrible and usually feature people leaving me, women breaking up with me.
Oh, what?
Oh, absolutely. Nearly all of my dreams are like this. And the other ones that I have, I'm wandering and wandering around a strange place, feeling lost. They're just about the only dreams I have, so I really don't like dreams. And, but of course, I'm sure I must feature in your dreams, Juliet.
Strangely, I don't have a very good memory for my dreams nowadays. I don't know if this means I'm not dreaming. And actually, my experience of dreams was sort of affected by, I think we've spoken a bit before on the podcast, I suffer from a condition called fibromyalgia. And part of that manifests itself in me lacking in good quality sleep, and not sleep at all, but that I don't go into very deep REM sleep very often. And that, of course, is the state in which one gets dreams. So actually, since I've had that for about sort of 8 or 9 years, my dreams are not as vivid as they used to be. I don't get them so much, I don't think, or at least I don't remember them anymore. But having said that, I do, the ones that I tend to remember, maybe this is human nature, Terence, that we always remember the very bad and the very good, maybe. And we don't remember the kind of the average. One of my favourite ever dreams was about the time that I dreamt that I was reading the back of the Elastica by Elastica LP sleeve, but I'd completely made up the song titles, Terence. That when I could see them in the same font as they are on the sleeve, but they were completely different titles. And I wish to this day that I'd written them down when I'd woken up, because it was so peculiar. It looked exactly the same, but they were wrong. I often have dreams of things being right but wrong. I had a great dream about my best friend from school's mum once, that she turned up to my house where I still was at home in Hastings with my parents, and she knocked on my door pushing a vegetable rack and said, or rather this woman knocked on the door pushing a vegetable rack and said that she was Amelia's mum when she wasn't, and a man that who wasn't Amelia's dad then came up behind her and said she was Amelia's dad. And I can distinctly remember saying, look, I know Amelia's parents and you are not them. And then I woke up and Amelia and her mum were very amused by this turn of events. So I don't know, it's strange, isn't it? I often get anxiety dreams, and it's interesting how, although Well, there's always, you can always joke that horoscopes are baloney, because if there are 12 star signs and 60 million people in Britain, how can 5 million people all have the same day? You could say the same thing about dream analysis, that, as you say, you were able to look up what your dream meant online, and you can often do this, look up dreaming about teeth falling out, or dreaming about horses, or that sort of thing. And interestingly, you'd think, oh, well, how can everyone have the same dream? That's just ridiculous. But it would seem that, and I've spoken to people, because I, like you, I'm not really into dream chat, and I have to be honest, and say that I realised the relationship that I was in once was probably going to end at some point when my other half insisted on telling me about her dreams all the time. And that was one of the first moments in which I started to think, I'm not entirely sure this is forever, as lovely as she was. But I, when I talk to people about things, we often find ourselves dreaming these similar dreams. And it's interesting that the human brain might be wired in a certain way that one has similar dreams that you can kind of Google. And actually, I had a particular dream, and I looked it up, and actually, it wasn't exactly a dream sort of journal, but it was in something online that kind of suggested that other people had this dream before. I can always tell if I'm feeling particularly tired or stressed, or that I'm particularly fraught. And I was telling my friend this the other day, who's actually quite a stout person that is not into woo at all. And as I said it, she went, oh, God, I think you need to book a holiday. I had a dream that I was outside my parents' house in the village where they live, and they live on quite a quietish sort of road. Traffic goes through it, but it's a lane, really. My friend used to call it the lane of certain death, but it's not at all. She just, you know, she comes from London. But they know all their neighbours pretty much. It's quite a friendly road, so often it's quite a communal road. And I had this dream that there was a three-wheeler van outside their house that I was obviously in charge of, and I'd left the handbrake not completely off, but just a little bit off. And it started to roll down the hill. And so I started to run after it, and I could never quite catch it up. And there was a moment, I think, where I might have got in a car to try and chase after it, and it very serenely glided off round the corner. So it was a bit of a panicky dream, but it wasn't, you know, sort of a fire and brimstone dream. It was the idea that things were just slightly beyond my control. And my friend said, yeah, maybe you do need to take a few days off and have a sit down. So it's interesting. I think there are some people that take dreams very seriously, and there are some people that, I have some friends that are sort of therapists and psychologists that do quite a lot of work around people's dreams. So one might say that is sort of perhaps quackery slightly, but I think there might be something in it, because I think it's nearer to psychology. Because of course sleep and dreams are linked to the activity of the brain. I'm more inclined to think there might be something in it than, you know, just the idea, you know, sort of reading the runes or that sort of thing. I'm not sure. But no, I don't have terrible dreams, but I do have memorable dreams.
It's curious that science has rattled through some of the mysteries of life over the centuries and come up with plausible and logical explanations for many aspects of human behaviour, but no one yet has really found a reason why we undergo these sensations, emotions while sleeping. And I wish I had some good dreams. They all do seem to be anxiety dreams. And if there was a drug that guaranteed I wouldn't dream at all, I'd take it. It's that bad.
Would you? Oh, gosh. Well, I'm sorry for your troubles. I mean, I'm not sure. And maybe you need to develop fibromyalgia and go on amitriptyline, because that seems to have kind of robbed me of my memory for most dreams. It has to be. Or maybe, you know, you could, like me, develop a talent for inventing new track listings, the classic album.
Well, on that cheerful note,
let's focus on the on the new track listings rather than the anxiety dreams.
Many listeners will be dreaming of further opportunities to hear or even see you perform in the coming week.
You've done that, well done.
And where might they do so?
Well, I am, so what am I doing this week? There's so much that goes on. I'm very much looking forward to going to see Public Service Broadcasting,
and
I like a lot. So
I'd be interested to see how they transfer what they do on record into the live environment.
Yeah, so they do lots of films as well, apparently, behind them. And it's at the Bexhill Delawarr Pavilion, so I'm really looking forward to going that on Wednesday night. But at the same time, thanks to the miracle of technology, I'll also be having a radio show on the radio. So I'll be doing Indie Wonderland, obviously not live, but there will be a show this week, 8 to 10. 10 p.m. on barricaderadio.com. I do Indian alt rock and miscellaneous, and then I'm having an excursion this Friday evening, so Friday the 27th. I, in my guise as Sheila's Take a Bow with my friend Letty, we are putting on a couple of bands at the Albion Pub, I think it is, in Hastings. Ooh. And we are putting on a band called Nervous Twitch, who I've seen before, who are excellent, coming down from the north, and also Letty's band the Dagger Debs as well. So I can never say that name, the Dagger Debs. So yeah, I'll be doing that. So do come along and say hello.
And I think you'll probably agree with me that if people want to know when the next podcast is immediately available, the best way to do so, I understand, Jules, is to subscribe.
Yes, you can subscribe on iTunes, which is quite a cool way of knowing when there is a new podcast. When there's I subscribe to loads of podcasts. Hilariously, I subscribe to ours as well, because I used to subscribe to it before I was on it. So I do have occasionally the odd spectacle of listening to my own vocal tics if I've forgotten to switch it off at the end of an episode of another podcast that doesn't have me on that I listen to. But yeah, I like subscribing to podcasts because it means that you get new ones that go automatically to your phone. So that's a, you know, what more could you possibly want?
Thanks to our dreamy executive producer,
yes,
Rona.
Indeed, yes.
And to play us out, Jules, a band named after my least favourite food item.
Oh, well, I'm sorry that boiled haddock never really took off, both as a career or a meal choice for you. No, so this band was sort of a 90s era Britpop band, and I was at the Indie Rock and Roll Festival this weekend. I think we'd spoken about it previously. Boston, it was a great time was had by all. It was wonderful. And I did a bit of DJing, and so I took some indie singles along on my records. And I was talking to a friend of mine who used to play in a band called Formula One, and it's called Emmett back in the 90s, and they used to play, they never had much success, but they used to play chart success, but they used to play quite a lot with different bands, and they used to play with this band a lot, and she said that they still come down and visit them sometimes in Hastings, and they're called Salad, and I just think this is a really classy kind of sort of upbeat pop song, really. This is Drink the Elixir.
You have been listening to a DACA Media production.